Welcome to the Radio 191 FM podcast.
Kia ora, morena koutou and haere mai. My name is Seb.
My name is Nico.
And you are listening to your 11 AM weekly R1 Tuesday news show here on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi Radio 1.
Coming up on the program, I tēnei rā, Seb spoke to Warren Tate, a world-renowned expert on MECFS, also known as chronic fatigue syndrome, its relation to long COVID and the impact that post-viral illness is likely to have on the medical system in the coming years.
After that, we have Nico, who spoke with Dame Catherine Healy on the subject of sex workers' rights and the urgent need for reform in this area. Following that, we'll be joined by Fox Mayer live. He's the editor of Critic. He'll be giving us the lowdown of this week's Critic issue number 8. Then finally, we'll have our own local zoologist, Andrew Johnston, for our third installment of our segment, Creature of the Week.
But before all of that, here is Eli Superfly with Monday.
Tuesday, and she's already left. Now I'm here, holding my breath. I'm told to come around Wednesday. Still no call back. Where did she go? Where did she run to? I'd really, really like to know. Guess it's safe to assume it's all my fault. On a car, I guess without them you wouldn't get too far. But knowing you, I'm sure you'd find a way. 8 AM Monday and I've got the blues. BB King's playing and I've lost my shoes. For a second I thought it was you, but I'm obviously mistaken. And even if somehow I could have shown you, oh. And even if somehow I could have shown you, and even if somehow I could have shown you, and even if somehow I could have shown you how much I really, really am. How much I really loved you. Mm-hmm.
That was Eli Superfly with Monday, and you are currently listening to R1 News. Coming up, we speak to Warren Tate, an expert on MECFS, otherwise known as chronic fatigue syndrome, and its links with long COVID. But before all of that, here's Eileen with the bulletin.
This is the news on Radio 1 91 FM.
Tēnā koutou, ko Eileen tēnei. Tesla CEO Elon Musk has finalised an agreement to buy Twitter for over $40 billion. Musk, who is the world's wealthiest person, said he wanted to purchase the social media platform as he believes it is not living up to its free speech potential. Initially, the board of Twitter was reluctant to engage with Musk, but opened negotiations as he outlined financial commitments he had made to support his bid. Once the sale closes, Twitter will become a privately owned company. Musk has pledged to make the platform more lenient regarding moderation and would reverse rules such as those which led to former US President Donald Trump being banned. Unions are calling for an inquiry into the safety of port workers after two deaths in less than a week. Last Tuesday, 26-year-old stevedore Atiroa Tuaiti died after a fall whilst working on a ship at the ports of Auckland. Yesterday morning, a Lyttelton Port Company worker was killed whilst working. Speaking to RNZ, Council of Trade Unions President Richard Wagstaff said urgent action is needed. He said the tragedies reinforced calls for an inquiry into health and safety measures for port workers, and that every worker deserves to know that when they go to work in the morning, they will be coming home safely at the end of the day. Workplace Relations and Safety Minister Michael Wood said he has received a request for an inquiry and is seeking advice from agencies. He told Morning Report that the number of fatalities and injuries in the sector is disproportionate and will be taken seriously. Work on the George Street upgrade is set to begin in Dunedin City Centre today. The block between Moray Place and St Andrew Street will be closed, with a detour in place. That section of work is expected to be completed in October. Finalised last year, the George Street upgrade will see Otipoti's main street become more pedestrian-friendly, with speed limits lowered and traffic becoming one way from the Frederick Street intersection to Moray Place. The upgrade project is expected to be completed in 2024. And that was the bulletin on the R1 News. Now, the weather.
The Radio 1 91 FM weather.
I tēnei rā, expect a cool but clear day, with southwesterlies strengthening in the afternoon and a high of 15, a low of 11. Āpōpō, Otipoti can expect cloud cover and showers, clearing through the afternoon with a high of 14 and a low of 8.
Tēnā koe, Eileen. That was your daily bulletin for Tuesday, the 26th of April. Coming up on the program, we've got a pre-recorded feature with Warren Tate, a world-renowned expert on MECFS, also known as chronic fatigue syndrome, its relation to long COVID, and the impact that post-viral illness is likely to have on the medical system in the coming years. But before all that, we've got one song for you, and this is Future Islands with Seasons. It's the Bad, Bad, Not Good remix. You got it tuned to Radio 1. You got it tuned to the R1 News Show here on Radio 1. That song was Future Islands. That song was Seasons by Future Islands. That was the Bad, Bad, Not Good remix. Coming up, I'm going to play a pre-recorded feature where I talk to Warren Tate, expert researcher on chronic fatigue syndrome. He's talking to me a bit about its connection to long COVID and the future impacts that post-viral illness will have on the medical system. Without further ado, here it is. Health organizations around the world are currently scrambling to prepare for a wave of post-COVID illness that we still know very little about. Long COVID is the term currently being used to describe the symptoms that continue or develop after the initial COVID-19 symptoms. According to the World Health Organization, long COVID has developed in about 30% of those infected with COVID-19 after their initial recovery from infection. Common symptoms of long COVID include fatigue, shortness of breath, cognitive dysfunction, but also others which generally have an impact on everyday functioning. Researchers in New Zealand have begun to tackle the question of long COVID. This research is building on key insights from studies of another post-viral condition, myalgic encephalomyelitis, otherwise known as chronic fatigue syndrome. The striking similarities between ME/CFS and long COVID in terms of the symptoms and the demographic that they affect has led some experts to postulate that long COVID could actually be a subtype of ME/CFS. Warren Tate is a biochemist at the University of Otago who has dedicated much of his research to ME/CFS. He believes that long COVID and ME/CFS are sister illnesses because of the core symptoms that they share. Tate is currently collaborating alongside Auckland cellular immunologist Dr. Anna Brooks to study long COVID and post-viral illness more comprehensively. Tate's interest in long COVID and his 30-year involvement in ME/CFS research stems from his own personal life. After becoming ill in 1990, his daughter has suffered from ME/CFS since the age of 14.
Being in a ME family myself, I understand these things really well. So in a way, I'm in a unique position because being a researcher as well as someone who's lived the talk and lived it, you have a much better understanding and empathy, really.
ME/CFS has a long and unfortunate history. Once maligned and often still neglected by the medical establishment, little research has been done into an illness which has blighted the lives of millions across the world for many years, largely due to the misconception that it was a psychosomatic disorder and not a physiological one.
There wasn't kind of worldwide interest in the disease or interest from a coordinated health profession or investment in understanding what it was about. And one of the characters that has come out of this was a British psychiatrist called Simon Wesley, who was the president of the Royal Psychiatric Society in Britain, and studied ME/CFS for about 20 years from the 1980s through to early 2000s. And despite the fact that he agreed that it had a viral origin, he thought it was a perception disorder. That is to say, people were perceiving their symptoms, perceiving their disability, and basically it was an opting out of life kind of syndrome where everything was just too hard to do anything. And so that influenced all of the UK thinking, and young people, like my daughter came down with this illness when she was 14, young people like that were often taken away from their families and put in psychiatric institutions, and some of them just withered away and died. It was just terrible.
It was internationally recognized research conducted by Tate that helped prove to the world that this disease wasn't merely a perception disorder, but an actual physiological illness.
I was determined towards the end of my research career, I thought it would be possible to try and work on it and find, if there were one, a biological basis for the disease. And we managed to find molecular signatures in the end of 2020. So that's what I set out to do. Without much money or support from mainstream investment agencies, even though I'd been on the Health Research Council board for 7 years and chaired the Biomedical Research Committee, but it wasn't seen as an important enough disease, even though it affected 25,000 New Zealanders.
Tate believes that the surge in interest relating to long COVID and post-viral diseases may be a blessing in disguise, not only for sufferers of ME/CFS, but also for researchers trying to better understand these illnesses.
What's happened with COVID is that everybody understands what COVID is. It's not just a boutique disease, you know, in Iceland somewhere affecting 500 people. It's affected 500 million people. And so it's everywhere. And the medical profession worldwide have woken up to, you know, to this. And no one doubts the fact that long COVID, which develops from COVID, is not a biological disease, because they've seen the COVID epidemic and they've seen these people get ill as a result of what we call long COVID now, and they've seen it directly related to COVID. So the blessing in disguise, you know, much as, you know, it's horrible to think people are going to be developing long COVID, is that the belief in the disease is, you know, profound now. Mm. And what we hope is ME/CFS people will be able to piggyback on this. Mm. Not only the belief, but money. I mean, money was just starting to come before the pandemic. In the US, there was a report from the Academy of Science Institute of Medicine, and they said ME/CFS has been a neglected disease. It's been a disgrace that the medical profession hasn't taken it more seriously, and in terms of putting in for caregivers and things like that. So I celebrated because the NIH said they were going to put $2 million into this research. That was amazing, you know. After COVID and then long COVID developing, the promises has been $1.15 billion has been promised to go into it. So that's the difference it's made.
According to Tate, the similarities between the diseases mean that by using ME/CFS as a model, researchers looking into long COVID have a head start, if only they choose to acknowledge it.
Unfortunately, what's happening at the moment is quite a few long COVID papers being published without any reference to ME/CFS. In other words, here we have a model for the disease. ME/CFS has come from multiple sources, multiple different viruses, you know, endemically in our student community now. It's glandular fever is a common cause. About 30% of all cases, you would say, probably come from glandular fever. In the case of COVID, of course, with so many more, we have 500 million across the world, and it looks like about 30% of people, certainly with the earlier strains, not so sure about Omicron, they go on to develop long COVID. So if you do the maths, you know, we're talking about a third of 500 million, putting a burden of, you know, 150 million or so on the world of this illness. In New Zealand's case, because in the first stages of COVID, we didn't get many cases, relatively. So we have 25,000 ME/CFS people, and at the moment we have just a few hundred long COVIDs that are known.
The impact that long COVID will have on the health system is predicted to be significant. From Warren's perspective, when it comes to long COVID, the response needs to be different than what it was with ME/CFS.
You know, really you would say the ME/CFS, the health response to that is chaotic. I mean, many clinicians don't have any idea what the disease is about, so their patients go and see them. So the care across the country is very dependent on which doctor you go and see. There's not any kind of current therapies really available. And so it's really a management strategy for the disease, and you're relying on a doctor who is pretty sort of up to date with that. There hasn't been any teaching in medical schools, you know, and now each year I go back and I'm asked to teach in that module. And so students, at least from Otago, have been getting some idea of what ME/CFS is like. So for ME/CFS, it's been chaotic. So what do we need? And the COVID and long COVID might be the answer. What we need is consistent at the Ministry of Health level understanding of the condition and clinical guidelines that go out to all clinicians, so that every patient that goes to a clinician will have the chance of having a consistent understanding in the doctor and also a consistent treatment. I think we have to ensure that in medical schools, both medical schools, there is discussion of this disease and its biological basis. And, you know, what we're trying to do is to completely cleanse the idea that it's got a psychological basis. And unfortunately, that's still getting mileage in medical schools. So that's something we can do.
Tait also believes it is critical that we group the two diseases, ME/CFS and long COVID, together because they are very much the same disease.
ME/CFS comes from a heterogeneous initiating agent like stresses. We thought it was all viruses, but now we know that surgery can do it to some people. Bacterial infections, agricultural chemicals, extreme stress in one's life can bring it on. Long COVID, of course, it's a pure form of ME/CFS, if you like, because there's just one initiating stressor, that's COVID-19. And so it'll have some characteristics of that initiating virus. It won't be identical. But we've actually just got data from a first comparative study, a pilot study of long COVID patients and ME/CFS, age, gender matched, and it's the first molecular evidence that long COVID is very similar to ME/CFS. And if you like, it's a clone of ME/CFS, so that's what I would sort of call it.
Recently, researchers surfaced claiming that to avoid long COVID, one must take it slow when resuming physical activity after having been infected with COVID-19. This ties into a common symptom often reported by ME/CFS sufferers, post-exertional malaise.
I mean, it's a cautionary tale. So when you have it, if you exercise, it can make the illness worse. That's a classic symptom of ME/CFS. We've done a big study on that now, where we're trying to understand kind of what molecular changes are occurring, you know, after someone exercises fairly extensively. One of the reasons is because we think that the stress center in the brain, it's in the hypothalamus, is not functioning properly. And so, you know, the brain's got very much disturbed physiological homeostasis, all sorts of things going on. And, you know, that would be a kind of a physiological and molecular reason why you'd want to just kind of basically do the rest, which is what we're asked to do all of the time. If we get the flu or something like that, just go, you know, go home, go to bed, rest up, have liquids and things like that. That's very good advice still.
While getting long COVID will largely come down to the individual and their immunological response, Warren offers simple advice as to how to avoid increasing your risk of getting it.
So certainly not going out and running half marathons and things like that, you know, 7 days after you've had COVID, I think.
Yeah.
Avoiding those kinds of things, just, you know, a gentle resumption of your normal activities. Very hard for students to do, I know, but...
Long COVID is set to have a significant impact on many communities across Aotearoa. It's Warren's belief that we must take into account the lived experiences from sufferers of ME/CFS, as well as generate enough awareness around these illnesses to create a better outcome for everyone. After talking to Warren, it's clear that what drives his research is a desire to protect the vulnerable.
The main thing is going to be that we use the knowledge that long COVID is there and it comes from you know, a viral disease, and it's got a biological basis, to get better understanding through the community of these post-viral fatigue syndromes, and also better social support, because, you know, the ME/CFS community have not had very good social support either. And, you know, so really community knowledge and understanding and, you know, looking after vulnerable people really is really the message which I try to put forward. Everyone that contacts me is very gracious, respectful, and whatever, you know, they're a group of people that you really want to help.
Most of Warren Tait's funding for research into these post-viral illnesses comes from unsolicited donations, mainly from families who have been afflicted by ME/CFS. Upon the request of the New Zealand Disease Association, Warren has set up a donation site through the alumni office at the University of Otago. This link, as well as others which provide support for research into these illnesses, can be found at r1.co.nz/news.
That was Sib, who was joined by Warren Tait, expert researcher on ME/CFS, otherwise known as chronic fatigue syndrome. Sib and Warren discussed the relation between chronic fatigue and long COVID and the future impacts that post-viral illness is likely to have on the medical community. Now, coming up, I am going to be speaking to Dame Catherine Healy on sex workers' rights, the progress that has been made and the work that is yet to be done. But first, here is Black Widow Spider by Parquet Courts.
You got it tuned to the R1 News Show here on Radio 1. The time is 26 minutes to 12, and that song you just heard there was Black Widow Spider by the band Parquet Courts. Coming up on the show, we're going to be moving into our second pre-recorded interview. Would you like to take it away, Nico?
I shall. I had the honour and pleasure of speaking to Dame Catherine Healy on the subject of sex workers' rights, more specifically the need to repeal Section 19 of the PRA, or Prostitutional Sex Workers Reform Act. Dame Catherine Healy is the coordinator of the NZPC, New Zealand Sex Workers Collective, and I asked her some questions on the PRA and the work of the NZPC as to why Section 19 of this PRA needs to be repealed. Section 19, just so everyone listening can get a better understanding, excludes all the same rights and protections for sex workers, for migrant sex workers, leaving them to be vulnerable to violence and exploitation and often too afraid to seek or ask for any help from police out of fear of deportation. Let's get into it. Catherine, you are the coordinator for NZPC, which focuses on both educating and advocating for sex workers' rights alongside the prevention of HIV and sexually transmitted infections. But why, for you personally, is it so necessary to have the NZPC?
Well, I was a sex worker when we formed our organisation in 1987 with one of the aims to decriminalise sex work. So we are NZPC, Aotearoa, New Zealand Sex Workers Collective. Very important for me personally to think that every sex worker is included and protected by legislation, that sex work is recognised in all contexts, regardless of someone's visa status.
Of course, definitely. And that leads to the question of why it is so important to repeal Section 19 of the PRA. Because as I understand it, it does, as you mentioned, exclude the rights and protections for, I believe, migrant sex workers, which makes them vulnerable. Could you tell me a bit more about this repeal and why it is needed and why you're advocating for this along with the NZPC?
I guess we've been advocating for it for a long time, and what happened in 2003 when the major shift in law occurred with the decriminalisation of most sex work-related activities, migrants were identified as a vulnerable population by some advocates outside of our organisation as being vulnerable to trafficking. And the then Minister of Immigration said that one of the solutions would be to have a clause be inserted into the legislation that would prevent migrants from coming to New Zealand. And at that time, we were right up against the wall seeking votes from politicians, and we felt that was a really inappropriate solution and that it would deliver harm. And it has, you know, quite clearly delivered harm to that particular part of the sex worker population. Criminalising someone for coming to New Zealand and working as a sex worker or deporting them on that basis is not a solution. And it's, you know, it feels on a very deep level a horrible breach of human rights. We have decriminalised most sex work-related activities in this country, and we would like migrants to be protected by the same legislation. I don't want to be taking phone calls, meeting with people who are incredibly distressed because they've been targeted by their clients because they are perceived to be migrants, or indeed they are migrants who are working here without those protections. And I want to say too that people who come here from other countries who sometimes don't come here with the intention of becoming sex workers. You know, we have, for example, students who are studying here and they run out of money. New Zealand's an expensive country, and some people have been caught short and said, look, the most obvious solution to them is to find other work, and some have chosen to be sex workers knowing or not knowing, in fact, that they're allowed to be or not allowed to be migrant sex workers, and have been caught and have been deported, having their studies interrupted. One case we were dealing with recently had a sex worker, someone who had been a sex worker historically and was in a relationship, and any other work would have been fine, except that sex work was identified, this person volunteered that they'd been a sex worker, and to immigration, and immigration had to conclude, and you know, they have to follow their own rules and laws, that they were the grounds that they could exclude this person from remaining in our country. So heartbreaking, horrific outcomes for some individuals. And of course, we've been working very hard. We have 37 organisations who support us on this cry to either repeal or amend the Act. And we also have the CEDAW Committee, which is a UN committee, the Committee to Eliminate Discrimination Against Women. They have made a recommendation to the government that it should look at amending this Act. And so that the research and the evidence that's been there, we've had major research projects in this area have identified that harm has been caused. So that's it, really. We are determined.
Mm. Is there a way of having a political instrument to try and achieve this? Like, what is the NZPC, what can be done to tackle this and to do the repeal of the PRA?
Well, because it exists in law, it has to, I imagine, go through the repeal process in the Parliament. So you've got 120 odd individuals with 120 different opinions, and you know, the ideal circumstance of course would be that government would pick it up, but we know it's more likely to go through a passage of a sponsorship. You know, if a member, for example, decided to sponsor it as a private member's bill, that's another effective way to get it across the line. That's what we did with the change change in legislation in 2003 for sex workers, when most sex work-related activities were, in fact, decriminalised. So, yeah, it takes a bit of courage, I guess, in that environment. Sex work, you know, debating sex work isn't popular. You know, sometimes people feel that they're up against it with conservative constituents or fellow members in their caucus or parliament. So, you know, it's a lot of work to achieve it, but it would be ideal for us if the government did follow on the CEDAW recommendation and amend this piece of legislation.
For sure. Thank you. And I guess a final question is that in relation to following the progress of this repeal, along with other information on both health and law related resources, how does the NZPC share this with the public? How can people listening become more engaged, perhaps, with this? Because I know that the website is very informative for the ZPC, but how else can people find resources?
Yes, there's quite a lot of questions I guess people will have about the status of sex workers in this country. We're now one of two countries that has decriminalised sex work. Belgium have just announced it's going to decriminalise sex work. So you can certainly Google away and come up with a lot of information, and you'll find sex worker sites all around, really, where this issue is discussed. And we would urge anyone who would like to support this amendment to make contact with us, and they could formally sign on. I know that Pandora did a petition, and that's been presented to the Parliament as well, which is fantastic. And that's hopefully going to trigger a response. So, you know, there are many ways to tackle this. Speak to your local Member of Parliament and speak to others who you think might support you. If you belong to a group, perhaps that group could get in touch and sign on with what we're doing, which is building an organisational approach. So when you have X amount of organisations saying, look, this is wrong, it's causing harm, and we can come up with a solution, then, you know, that makes politicians listen.
Definitely. Thank you. And do you have anything else that you'd like to say in regards to either the NZPC or any other resource?
If you have any queries, just pop online, send an email, and we welcome, you know, that engagement. And we have an Instagram and Twitter account as well, so we're easy to find, NZPC, so we pop up. And be supportive, stick up for sex workers in whatever environment you're in, because there's often that casual stigmatisation, jokes are made about sex workers, and it's, you know, just not cool.
Definitely. Thank you so much.
You got it tuned to the Radio 1 news show. That was Nico having a fascinating conversation with Dame Catherine Healy on sex workers' rights and the pledge to repeal Section 19 of the PRA, essentially to help support migrant sex workers.
And now we are about to be joined live by Fox Mayer, editor of Critic, the Dunedin student magazine, and he is going to give us the lowdown on this week's issue. Kia ora, Fox. How are you? And thank you for joining us.
Kia ora. It's good to be here.
Thanks, mate. Issue 8.
Yes.
We're that deep into the semester, aren't
yes,
we?
Yes, deep into that
crazy
semester.
So your editorial this week was on Good Friday. You had a rather large bone to pick with Good Friday as a public holiday. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, it obviously, the editorial section is just a chance for me to whinge, and every year over that weekend, I go out and I try to plan to do something, and I save all the shopping till the Friday, and I go shop. And apparently, because some dude was nailed to a cross 2,000 years ago, it means that I can't buy my trip supplies, which I think Jesus would have agreed with as well. But, you know, that's just my take. You know, there's plenty of reasons to celebrate it. I just don't know why we call it Good Friday when it was, you know, it's a day of remembrance. That's always been confusing.
Right. And it requires just too much planning, too much forethought.
I have to put an entire notification into my calendar to remind me that this is a holy day, apparently.
I feel like we've been caught short as well.
We have, yeah. We always forget to do our supermarket run. It's a frustrating one, isn't it?
Just a wee bit. And there's been quite a bit of news in this week's issue, around 15 pages, which is, I reckon, quite a newsworthy week. What are some of the news pieces which stood out to you?
Well, one of the pieces that stood out to me this week was Zach's piece on the phosphate-carrying ship. It wasn't something that I'd known much about, but in his report he described that, you know, there's this quote-unquote complex geopolitical situation in which one country has invaded another and there's some human rights violations there. And the only two companies outside of the Moroccan regime that controls that place are in New Zealand that buy this product, one of which shipped into Port Chalmers last week. And this has been going on for around 40 or so years, so it's not exactly new. It's just that, you know, in the time that it's taken for us to write about it, we've had like two generations born, so they might not really know about what's going on.
That's quite crucial coverage then.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy that it's got a space in the magazine, that we've got a reporter looking at it.
Awesome. Anything else? I saw that you wrote an article on a suspected drink spiking at a BYO.
Yes, that occurred a while ago, and we've actually just been informed that the story that I was given by one of the clubs and one of the people, and that wasn't exactly what it added up. It sounds like there was some miscommunication along the way, but yeah, everybody involved in it is fine now, and the hospital gave us some very informative information on what to do if you suspect you find yourself in a similar situation.
Can you give us a slight rundown of what happened?
What happened
at the BYO?
At the BYO. Well, it sounds like it was a publicly available event in order to raise numbers for the club. Two people had adverse reactions to their drinks that probably weren't alcohol. There was no real apparent idea as to whose drinks were spiked and why. It seemed random, according to the club members, and they were very confused as to who did this and why.
Right. Fascinating. A bit dark also. In lighter news, you had the great critic Te Arohi Flat Garden competition. Is this the inaugural competition, or has this happened before?
Oh, this is the first that I know about, but who knows how long we'll keep doing it for. It was fun. One submission that we didn't get to put in there, somebody had 6 square meters of black mold growing on their ceiling, which I thought counted as an honorable mention, but we couldn't get a photo of that in time, so it didn't make it into the magazine.
Great. Do you yourself have a flat garden, or are you more of a basil and a beer pong cup kind of guy?
Well, last year our flat had a cactus in the backyard that bloomed every year and was about 3 meters tall. So last year we definitely had a garden. This year, not so much. It's more of a patio kind of deal going on.
Who does the judging in the competition for the flat garden?
This week, I think it was judged initially by Sean, but we editorialized and moved some stuff around at the last minute because we have the privilege to do that.
You do. It's a gorgeous competition. I really love how the winner started her entire garden from New World, My Little Garden.
New World Cup,
it's
yeah.
So cool.
Just little seedlings took right off.
And we're neighbors with the second place winners as well, and their garden is so great. I love going next door and just having a little.
Does look fantastic.
Geese.
You've stolen their kale before, haven't you?
Yes, and I hope Ruby's not listening because I think I killed it.
Anyway, Fox, it's an amazing issue. Thanks for joining us, and can't wait for issue 9, mate.
Thank you very much. Next week is Conspiracy. We'll see what happens.
Ooh,
we'll see.
Exciting. Thank you.
That was Fox Mayer, editor of Critic Te Arohi. Coming up on the show, we're talking to Andrew Johnston, local zoologist, about the weta. But before that, we've got Faye Webster with In a Good Way.
I didn't know what I was capable of being happy right now, but you showed me how. I didn't know that you were right in front of me until I looked up. You make me wanna cry in a good way.
Faye Webster with In a Good Way, and you are tuned into Radio 1 91 FM for R1 News. And we're about to be joined live by our friend and local zoologist Andrew Johnston to talk about a local animal. This week, Andrew is talking to us about Witter.
G'day, Andy. How are things, bro?
Good, man. How are you?
Good. You had a good break, mid-sem break?
I did, yeah. I did. Very family-oriented, you know.
Lovely.
Yeah, went back
very
home.
Important.
Yeah.
What are we talking about today, Andy, on Creature of the Week?
Yeah, so this week we are looking at the wetter, which is a...
Exciting.
Yeah, pretty awesome animal in New Zealand.
Creepy crawly.
Creepy crawly, for sure, but a lot of variety, as we'll learn throughout the show, I'm sure. Over 100 species of them.
My gosh, that's a lot.
Yeah, we've got a lot of content
all
to get through.
All in Aotearoa.
Yeah, so they're endemic to Aotearoa, but... there are a few. They're part of the same family as like crickets and locusts and stuff. So there's other like similar species around the world. There's a few in Australia, a few in sort of South America, and that kind of stuff as well. But
it's just when I was looking into it, I was struggling to is the plural of wetter wetter?
Yes.
Okay.
I think so.
We're not saying wetters, right?
No.
Okay,
I think yeah, plural wetter.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, this is your area of expertise, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
You are studying.
I am.
Wetter.
I am. Yeah. So for my master's that I'm doing here at Otago, I'm looking at the Maho Nui giant wetter as a thesis project. Yeah.
Gorgeous.
Yeah, they're pretty amazing.
Is it that giant?
Creatures. Yeah, I mean, they're pretty big, right? They're like, you know, giant wetter. They get up to like 10 centimeters long, right? So they're pretty big guys. But the Maho Nui giant wetter, the reason I got attracted to them is because they have this amazing adaptation where they've decided to live in gorse bushes.
Oh.
So, you know, gorse bush is like an invasive species.
We don't like gorse.
We don't like gorse, right? Generally speaking, in New Zealand, it takes over a lot of land. But for the wetter, because it's such a prickly plant, the wetter can get in there and live in there, but it protects them from things like rats and stoats and everything. So it kind of becomes a bit of a nursery for them. It's like a natural protection.
Oh my gosh.
It's really interesting.
Yeah. From invasive plant to...
To nursery. Basically, yeah. Which is pretty incredible. So I'm looking at sort of their occupancy over the last 20 years and how they're doing and the pest control in the area and how that's working. Because they've only... been rediscovered quite recently. Like, they were rediscovered in 1962, I think it was.
Right.
And up in King Country in Maho Nui.
Amazing.
In Tikui. Yeah.
Rediscovered. We thought they were extinct.
And then we found them again, just this little patch of land up there, and now we're trying to protect them, and yeah.
And what is their status? Because there's heaps of different species, like types of wetter.
Yeah.
Like, are they all endangered, or are some of them thriving?
Some are definitely thriving, some are endangered. Yeah, it's sort of a mix of both. So, generally speaking, so we kind of categorize wetter into five broad groups when we talk about wetter. So like I said, there's over 100 species, but yeah, there's five groups. So you got the tree wetter, which is the most common one. So they're the ones that are absolutely thriving. They're doing great. They're, as the name suggests, they live in trees, you know, and...
Checks out.
And then you have the ground wetter, which, unsurprisingly, live in the ground as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the cave wetter, which is a bit of the curveball, because they don't usually live in caves, funnily enough. They also are found in forests and other kind of dark, damp places.
Doesn't check out,
right? So just to keep you on your toes. But they're kind of interesting, because they can jump 3 meters, the cave wetter. They've got a big jump, which is pretty...
And how big are they?
They're not as big as, say, like what your giant wetter would be. They're a bit smaller, kind of the same size as a tree
But 3 meters for a jump... For a jump for an animal that's not 3 meters
pretty tiny,
long.
Yeah.
That's then, crazy, man.
Yeah, and then just to wrap it up, you've got the tusked wetter, which have their little tusks, which they use for fighting, and then you got the giant wetter, which is sort of the most like charismatic one, you know, the one that we know the most.
And am I right in saying that we've just discovered some more?
Yes.
That is a trip.
Absolutely.
I'm keen to dive into that, but... What the hell? We're still discovering new animals?
Yeah, I know.
It's 2022. Why?
It's incredible, right? Yes, the reason that we thought we'd do wetter today is because there's an article that came out recently where six wetter alpine wetter were discovered, which is just insane, right?
Here in New Zealand.
Yeah, here in New Zealand. So basically, it's a little bit of a bittersweet story, unfortunately, because as we have climate change going on, we're having the world, you know, the Earth warming up. which is allowed the Alpine Zone to retreat higher up the mountain, which has made their place where they live more accessible, and so we've been able to find them and distinguish them, characterize
right.
them. So awesome that we found these new species, but not great. Yeah.
Impending
that we found
doom
them.
For civilization, hey, some more weather.
But new weather, right? How cool. So that's really amazing. And yeah, like you say, isn't it just awesome that we're still finding
that trips me out.
New species all the time.
So how are these species different to what the ones we already know about?
The new six,
the new,
I mean, not we don't know too much about them yet, obviously, because they've just been recently discovered, but it seemed to be some sort of alpine wetter, so I think they're probably going to be some sort of ground wetter or tree wetter or something like that fit into these poor groups.
Yeah.
But once we kind of have a bit more scientific knowledge on them, we'll know.
Amazing.
Which is pretty cool. But alpine wetter are pretty exciting species themselves, just because there's a amazing alpine wetter in here in Otago, in the Otago region, that ends up completely freezing itself over winter because the temperature gets too cold. It's there's nothing for it to eat, there's nothing for it to do, so it just ends up freezing itself.
It just like hibernates, it just sleeps.
So it has this amino acid in their blood, which is called hemolymph, and basically it prevents their organs from freezing, but 82% of the water in their body completely freezes over. Which is insane.
Gosh.
Yeah, it's like a superpower, right?
It's just like a super siesta.
Yeah, exactly.
What a nap.
And do you have any other fun facts or factoids about wetter?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the most amazing, most interesting wetter that we usually think of is the giant wetter, right?
Mm-hmm.
So some interesting things about that. One of the wetter giant wetters is called the wetterpunga, which is the also known as the little barrier giant wetter. And they're about 10 centimeters long, as I said, but they can weigh about 35 grams, which is the same as like a mouse or a sparrow.
Oh,
so they're one of the heaviest insects that we have on Earth. It's crazy.
Landing on you.
Yeah, I know. Like, there's some awesome photos up there of the giant wetter eating like carrots and stuff. You should definitely have a look. It's great. But the name wetterpunga in Treorc sort of translates roughly to God of Ugly Things, which is, I don't know, maybe harsh, maybe
ooh.
Not.
Well,
yeah,
it's shade.
Yeah, a little bit of shade, right? Yeah, but I mean, they are pretty creepy to look at, so you can understand why.
I was just going to bring up, you told me before the show that there's actually a wetter named after our very Prime Minister.
There is, absolutely.
An honour, maybe, or dishonour, it depends on your opinion on wetters.
Yeah, exactly, and you're probably your political spectrum and whatnot as well, but the article I read was for honour. It was honouring Jacinda Ardern because it was this that was the Prime Minister that was named after. It was this new species that was discovered. It was this, like, as the article described it, this gorgeous red variant of wetter.
Yeah.
And so in honour of Jacinda Ardern, we now have the Jacinda Ardern wetter, which, excuse my pronunciation, but I think it's the Hemiandrus Jacinda is the scientific name. Yeah.
<That's> so good.
Which is great, right?
That's so crazy. And can you tell us, just to wrap it up, a bit about what you're directly doing with wetter a little bit more?
Sure. So my involvement is with these Maho Nui Giant Wetter, and so I'm looking at
Tuesdays,
sort of working closely with the breeding program that they've got.
Sorry about that.
Oh, no.
Little interruption there.
That's all good. Technical difficulties. They happen.
Technical difficulties.
They always happen.
A lot at Radio 1. But
No worries. But the I'm working with the breeding program that's happening there, so we're trying to make the environment at the breeding program area better for them so we can breed them and boost up the population that's there. And I'm sort of doing a pest control summary of the area so we know what pests are in the area in order to potentially make a predator-proof fence so that we can house these wetter in a more safe environment for them to thrive.
What are their predators?
In the area, so they're protected, like I said, by the bigger mammals like rats and stoats and whatnot. But smaller things like mice can sometimes get into the gorse bush, which is a bit of an issue, and also wetter come down to the ground to lay their eggs. They have an ovipositor that injects the eggs into the ground. They can lay like 100, 200 eggs at any one time. But when they come to the ground, then they're vulnerable, right, to any predators. Like, even things like hedgehogs will eat them. So,
So it seems like it'd be counterproductive, but if it's their home and their nursery, are you planting more gorse to help protect them?
Yeah, well,
really?
we're not planting more gorse, but we're protecting the gorse that's already there.
Right,
so
okay.
It's the only nature sanctuary in New Zealand where gorse is a protected plant species. Yeah, it was crazy. And they also have a herd of wild goats in there as well that go and graze the gorse to keep them alive. But something's happening in the reserve called succession, where basically they're trying to plant more and more native bush slowly over the years to transition from the gorse to the native bush.
Right.
So slowly bring them back into the native environment. Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Thank you for the lovely work you're doing around these beautiful creepy crawlies, man.
No worries.
It's awesome. It's inspiring. We've run out of time, unfortunately, to talk more about this topic, which we could have gone on for days.
I can talk for days.
Fascinating little animal.
If you want to learn more, feel free to pop over to my Instagram or my TikTok or anything like that, andyjohnston.wildlife, and yeah, we can talk more about that.
You know where to find him. That was Andrew Johnston talking about the weta on our Creature of the Week segment. It's unfortunately come to the end of your Tuesday news show here on Radio 1. Time to say goodbye, Nico.
Do we want to recap quickly?
Should we recap?
We can do a recap rundown.
All right. First up, we talked to Warren Tate, a world-leading expert on chronic fatigue syndrome. He talked to us a little bit about its relationship to long COVID and the impending health crisis that's coming to New Zealand if we don't prepare ourselves for long COVID and post-viral illness in general.
We then spoke with Dame Catherine Healy on the subject of the need to repeal Section 19 of the PRA, which prevents migrant sex workers from being able to work and receive the same protection and legal protection that other sex workers can receive in New Zealand.
That was a great yarn, because she was a dame.
Yeah.
That's big news.
It was so cool talking to her. I was freaking out. It was so nuts.
After that, we had Fox Mayer, the editor of Critic Te Arohi, the local student magazine. He talked to us a little bit about the issue number 8, his editorial bagging on Good Friday.
For fair reasons.
Yes. We talked about the inaugural flat garden competition that they had.
Mm-hmm.
A great, great little comp there. And then after that, we had the legendary Andrew Johnston talking to us about weta. What a show.
It was great. And we'll see you next week.
See you next week. Time to wrap it up. We'll leave you with Lady Six with her song Icarus. You've got it tuned to Radio 1. Stay locked.
FM podcast. All of our content lives online at r1.co.nz.